This week's episode has been brought to you by the paid subscribership of Resilient Support, Michael, The Deal Company, and Scott. Hello and welcome to the Dad Podcast. This is episode number 66. I am here yet again with my father, Mr. Jesse Worsham. This is coming out the week of Halloween. We're coming off of a humongous trip to Plains, Texas. So we got a lot to cover, a lot to get to, Pops.
Yes.
But first, the reason I brought up Halloween is because on our trip, I actually listened to a podcast where somebody said something about the fact that, you know, this crazy, you see it a lot, but they were talking about a house in particular that had like dead bodies, and it said like "you're next" in blood splatter and stuff on the garage. And evidently the cops were called a couple of times about, you know, this house, and people were complaining about how scary it was. And one of the things that one of the people on this podcast said was, who would want to scare children like this?
I volunteered.
Yeah. And so I instantly go, make a mental note to talk about that with Dad, because your favorite thing, so much so that I didn't enjoy trick-or-treating as much when I was a kid. I would rather stay behind and watch you make 8-year-old princesses cry at our front door. But you didn't do it with blood or gore or guts. You would just open the door and go, what do you want? And then that would scare them, or, ah! And that was enough.
Well, because I would watch them through the peephole.
Yeah.
And as they approached the door or something, I would just jerk it open and yell at them.
Before they even got to knock.
Before they even got to knock.
That's right.
My hand was going up, and I just opened the door and yell at them. The other thing that I did.
Now, I remember real quick, before you move on, and then we'll rattle off all of the things that you do, that you did, because it was awesome, is my favorite part about you and being your son is that you could literally look at an 8-year-old girl in a Barbie princess Halloween costume crying and go, here you go, put candy in her bucket and just send her on her fucking way.
It was fun.
And you would not say, oh, I'm sorry, or
no,
anything. You have no remorse.
Wouldn't even apologize to the parents on the sidewalk. With a shocked look on their face.
Now, it's not really. Here's the thing. It was really funny to me as a kid. And I like to think that I could appreciate it. But I'm sure that there are parents out there listening to this that are like, that's not fucking funny because, you know, it's happened or to them in some way, shape, or form. But how is it that you could not care about making these little girls cry?
Because it was just the experience of shocking them.
Uh-huh.
They thought this process was going to happen. They're going to knock on the door, trick or treat, get some candy,
and go on.
And then I just took it way off 180 degrees the other way. They still got their candy,
right?
But it was fun just to shock them.
But why? So you just like shocking them because it entertained you, or you thought it was good for them, or both?
It was a little bit of both. It entertained me because again, you just knock them off where they thought they were going, and all of a sudden, bam, they're over here, and they don't know what to do.
I cannot stress enough to the listeners of this podcast how there would be a little cute girl crying and parents looking at her going, what the fuck is your problem? And my dad,
I did get some of those
biggest shit eating grin on his face, just give out candy.
Well, I'm just laughing and slapping my knees and putting candy in. It was
hilarious. And we had like next to no decorations, except for maybe Christmas decorations, which at the Worsham house,
really
they were year round.
Yeah,
sorry,
nothing for Halloween. Because if you had your entrance all scary and everything, they would be expecting something. So this is plain vanilla.
Not decorating.
Not going to be a problem
to
here.
To heighten the shitting effect that would happen when you open the door. I love every bit of it. I love it. So
really
now, so you would open the door, yell, go back to the things you were saying about.
Well, I also had an amplifier.
Oh, that's right.
Connected with a microphone.
Yes.
And I would watch out this peephole, and I had speakers that I could switch to.
That were hidden. You couldn't see them.
Hidden in the plants and the shrubbery. It would be behind them, off to the side. And they would go to knock or ring the doorbell, and I'd just growl at the speaker behind them. And they would just be shocked. They didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Or I would speak to them in the speaker behind them, tell them not to touch the door.
Yeah.
And they're looking around trying to figure out who else is out here.
And then you'd open the door and yell at them.
And I'd open the door, yell at them, and give them some candy.
Make them cry. Now, the teenagers, though, loved it. So much so, I remember there was about four, maybe six teenage guys that came and knocked on the door. You scared the shit out of them. So then they came back, but they didn't understand that, much like Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men, you stood watch.
Yes, indeed we did.
And, you know, because someone has to. And so you just sat all Halloween night, not even on a bar stool, just hunched over.
Just hunched over looking at the people at the door.
Sciatic nerve waiting to happen later.
I'd go to the chiropractor the next day.
Yeah, but you would look. And so I just remember the elation of someone playing back with you, because these boys walked up. And then they hid behind, and then one ran up to knock on the door real quick, and you saw them start, a bunch of them start to hide.
Yeah, they hide around the corner and stuff. They were going to jump out when I opened the door, but I already knew that they were there.
So you immediately said, Justin, you answer the door, but give me a minute, and ran through the house, through the kitchen, through the garage.
Out the garage.
Out the gate, and then came around, and then I, being 8, 9, at the time, opened the door, and they kind of, oh, and then they came and got their candy, and then you were right behind them.
So they were going to scare me, but I got them back anyway.
Oh, damn it. Oh, gosh. Oh, it was great.
That's what holidays are for.
So how say you, Father, on the guy who puts blood in zombies? Because, I'm different, though. I am in a land... I think I'm going to just say what I think, in that I feel in a lot of ways I'm in a land of pussies, especially after our trip. If anybody's a friend of mine on Facebook, and we'll get into the trip a little bit later, but in so many words, I found out that in the year, in the early, mid-30s, or so early 40s is what it really was, because what, Grandpa was born in 36?
31.
31, sorry. So in 1936, that's why that number stuck in my head, my grandfather was 5 years old. And I found out from his older brother, who was 4 years older than him,
correct,
that they were working, how many acres did I hear, 480? Does that sound about right?
They originally, from theirs, was 80 acres.
Oh, okay.
Was their parcel of it. His grandfather, the farm that they actually worked, would have been 200 acres.
Okay. So 80 acres then, excuse my hyperbole, but 80 acres... were being plowed on the old school, like whatever PBS special where there's a still photo doing the Ken Burns effect, you know, and there's a guy in a straw hat and some kind of larger shirt that was too big for him, and he's got two handles, you know, whatever oldie-timey plow you think of. Whenever you think of a plow, this was it. Just two handles and a little knife at the end of it, and two donkeys each of them. My 9-year-old great-uncle, is that the right term for it?
Yeah.
And then my 5-year-old... grandfather plowed 80 acres of field while their father was working on an oil rig.
He went off into the oil fields
because there was
not that much money to be made in farming. There was no other work or anything around, but he could work in the oil fields, either repairing pumps, maintaining them, watching them, recording the information off them. Because back then they had to go to each pump to find out how much that pump was actually pumping in oil. So he was a record keeper, just jack of all trades in the oil industry.
And so my point is that he would leave these
two children,
essentially farm 80 acres of land. And at first I was like, wow, how cool is that? And then my next thought is, my kid is a colossal pussy. And so am I, in a lot of ways. I mean, probably even more so than my child, I would imagine. But it's just crazy for me, and that's what I took out of it. So to cut back now to talking about Halloween is that it doesn't bother me that guys make their houses look like car crashes, and there's, you know, clowns that have the morbidly yellow teeth and jagged and all that stuff, because I am of the opinion that if you want to live in the suburbs and you're going to go trick-or-treating and say some guy wants to scare the shit out of some kids because he's passionate about Halloween.
Fair game.
Stay the fuck away from his house if your kids can't handle it. Like,
That's why I didn't decorate my house. More kids would come so I could scare them.
Well,
if you decorate up, they're going to stay away.
People could please write letters about my father, of course. But the guy, it's like there's strobe lights and shit. And the, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I don't have a problem with that. It's because to me, I also look at it. I don't have a problem with it, but I think it's interesting that now you can have a television commercial for cell phones that have zombies in them with, you know, full makeup. And I don't, this is probably, I think everywhere, depending on where you are, has some equivalent because we have all of the theme parks in Los Angeles become Halloween themed. Of course, Disneyland just brings out their pussy villains for the night or whatever. But you have not scary farms is what they have. And right. So they have this commercial where there's like really graphic makeup of our, and they joke about how this is the time of year we bring out our organic fed zombies. And, you know, cuts this guy where he's got bone and you just see the muscle tissue in his face and his eyes are all sunken. And now I look at that and I go, I imagine there are people who are offended by that. I don't care. I really don't give a shit about it. I think because I could just look at my kid and if he goes, holy shit, what's that? I go, it's a fake dude in some makeup. And I don't know. I don't know if I'm being unfair about it. But so here's my point. How say you, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Why do you like scaring the shit out of kids on Halloween? And do you think that people should be allowed to do so?
I like it because you snap that kid out of what his reality is or her reality is. Uh-huh. And you see them really react to their true core because they weren't expecting this. All of a sudden, bam, it's in their face. So they're either going to be, you know, flight or fright or whatever, but it's how they would really react to a situation in their own life where if you lead up to them or anything like that and you don't scare them, you don't get a real pure reaction out of them. Once they're scared, that's just pure emotion. That's what you're going to see out of that kid.
But how is it that you could do this with zero guilt?
Because it's fun. It's entertainment. It's enjoying.
Because we talked a lot about it.
But, are you saying guilt because I'm frightening these kids or scaring them? No, it's fun. I think it's once they realize what's going on, it's fun for them. They were frightened, but then it's okay, it's not going to hurt me.
Right.
So it's just their reaction. What I get the kick out of is just their reaction. That total just off guard, nail it, and see where they go.
Yeah.
That's what I love. That's the part of it. I do that to, your dog, I do the same thing.
Yeah.
He'll be sleeping on the floor and stomp my foot by his head, and he jumps up on his back, feet going crazy. And
I forgot that just about that. It's my poor fucking dog. He's got like 3 feet in a grave right now. He's about to punch his ticket, and he just is an old hound dog, just passed out. All 120 pounds of them. And my dad sneaks up with our wood floors and our hollowed out crawl space floor, goes right next to like the nape of his neck and just stomps as hard as he can. And it's funny to me because I have a visceral.
Now you know I do it.
Because I'm your son. No, because here's the thing. I really truly believe that normal people look at that and go, oh, poor. They want to laugh. Like, I really think there's a...
Well, they're laughing.
You know what I mean? Like the Romans would throw poor people in with bears and shit and watch them get eaten.
Get torn apart.
Yeah, there's a part of every human that likes that. You know what I mean? That's why we keep up with those Kardashians. There's
right.
We like a train wreck. You know, we all slow down and rubberneck whenever there's a semi turned over. Not necessarily going, oh, what was that guy carrying? Or I wonder if his tags were up to date. But it's like, oh, am I going to see somebody's brain today? You know what
right.
I mean? So I understand that we have that macabreness, I guess, in us, but a normal person would look at it and go, oh, but I have that at the same time, like going to go, oh, like they would have that reaction.
But everybody,
I buckle over like I've had a hypnotic trigger and somebody said banana and now I have to start acting like Billy Joel. You know what I mean? Like I could barely breathe. And it's that, and watching a dog run into a sliding glass door just fucking kills me.
It is hilarious.
It is hilarious.
But you get that somewhat from your grandfather.
Really?
Well, he would watch, like, NASCAR.
Mm-hmm.
He would watch rodeo. Not for the sport of it or anything. In NASCAR, he waited for the car crashes. in rodeo or something, he waited for somebody to get thrown off a horse or a bull and get stomped.
I remember him talking about how much he liked the clowns because it was their job to get in front of an angry 480-pound bull.
And he'd just double over laughing if that clown got nailed by the bull. I mean, he just thought it was hilarious. I mean, he'd almost wet his pants laughing at just that clown almost getting killed.
Yeah.
But that was his way of dealing with things.
So if we take away this thing where you can decorate your house for Halloween and scare the shit out of people, it's not Halloween then, right? Like,
you're right.
Yeah, then it's...
Well,
it's like,
and not that we...
And here's the thing. We're not talking about doing this every day. It's one night a year that your kid's going to have... You're going to have to say some shit to your kid. Go, well, that's not real. And yeah, blood's... Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
Well, if they're going to go home and have nightmares about this, they need to cowboy up. I mean, come on.
These 8-year-olds. You keep quoting Grow a Pair? Is that what it is?
Grow a Pair. That's a great book.
That's okay. We'll click through our Amazon link when you get it on Kindle. I evidently have. Sorry.
You got to get that.
I heard a train and I thought it was my dog barking in the backyard.
No.
I need to read that according to my father, but I agree with you. So now, so that's all. I just was curious about that and I thought it would be fun to have the listeners hear
about
your psychosis.
Well, I've done both ways. With a neighbor, I decorated the whole entrance of the house. We made like a wooden coffin.
Shorty, you're talking about, right?
Shorty.
I have a story about this.
We stuck people in that coffin, and then they would watch the kids because it's all black lights and stuff.
Him and his kids.
They'd reach out and grab the kid and take their candy away from them.
So we had like a, I don't know, I think it's a very 80s design on a house, like late 70s, early 80s design of a house where you had what is probably an 8 to 10 foot entryway, stucco with a flower bed on one side, a 3 to 4 foot wide
right along the side
walkway.
Of the garage.
Yeah, right along the side of the garage. You'd walk up, and then there would be a window that would be in the kitchen, and then the entry door would be there. And so there were these two foot by two foot kind of stucco pillars.
They were just fake.
And sheeted off those and closed it all in, and he decorated it. And then each of his kids dressed like a monster, and they would sit in like a statuesque pose. And then at various times when you walked up, they would come at you. Like, that was the extent. Now, I'm sure there's, like, real high text. My kids are too young to be able to go through any of the haunted houses. Living A, in Los Angeles, and B, in Burbank, where most of the production people live, I'm really afraid, to be honest. I'm genuinely fucking afraid.
This could be good.
Right. Like, you might, you know what I mean? You never get, you get the, you know, the second level prop master from Walking Dead who's like, this is my time to shine, asshole. I'm going to go fucking nuts on you. And this is what I do for a living. And so I have it when my kids get older, I'll be able to check it out. And actually I might go home with nightmares. But so this time it was just these kids. And I actually remember when I had to be 4 or 5 because you and mom weren't split up yet. And she took me trick or treating and I was dressed as Chewbacca in the old vinyl apron. And then the plastic thing you could barely breathe in and just get all moist and then I had, for whatever reason, I had a flashlight that I thought was a lightsaber. But I think you might have just bought an Usher, like a theater attendant.
Exactly. Going cheap on you.
I can't believe you just said exactly. Because to this fucking day, I thought, what a fucked up lightsaber that we used to have when we were kids. And you see these ones that they could build
a Disney. Just a red cone.
Yeah, what's that when I got the job? This is so funny to me right now. When I got the job at Great America, and we'd like be like theater attendants for concerts and stuff, and they give us those same flashlights. I'm like, hey, so this looks like the flashlight, the lightsaber I had.
Lightsaber? No wonder it didn't work right.
That's funny. But anyway, so I was Chewbacca carrying a lightsaber because I was very into the universe of Star Wars and the integrity and continuity. But so this guy and mom was playing along, and this guy was dressed as Frankenstein. I think one of his older kids or something like
that. Yeah, it was Ricky.
And so he comes out and he's reaching for me. And I was a pussy of a kid. This is one of the very few brave moments I ever had as a child. And my mom was like, get him. And I go, I got him, mom. And I fucking swung that thing like a fast pitch softball, you know, lesbian, and I just wilted that thing around and got him right in the gonads and just buckled him to his knees. And I go, let's go. And I've never been more proud because I was young enough to not know that it was them in dress up, but also old enough to know that
it wasn't real.
It wasn't real. So it wasn't a real Frankenstein. I just know who the hell it was but anyway. So that was, you know, the haunted house extent. And I'm sorry I took you off track on that, but I can't remember what we were going to talk about. I guess we were saying that it's not Halloween if you can't scare people.
Well, if you can't, but I think it's great to scare them like that. What I feel is a sad type thing is people that want to do that and would really take it up a great deal are now afraid to it because some pussy parents are going to sue them or something because they harm their kid or, you know.
Because they harm their kid.
Yeah, you know.
So he got fucking wounded.
Yeah.
Cowboy up,
grow a parrot, get out of here.
I know what you mean, but I do like the idea that in the context of this conversation, so your kid got fucking hurt. Now he's got a story.
Get over it.
So he's got 9 fingers. What the fuck? Lots of people.
Well, no, they mentally hurt
I know what
him
you mean.
Or whatever,
I know what you mean,
but
yeah.
But I
there
think
has actually no real harm done.
No. And I think it's sad in society today that we have to dumb down and not put it out there because we're afraid of the aftermath or what's going to happen.
Right.
You know, when I was doing this to kids, there was no real thought of that. It was only scare the hell out of them, get their reaction, give them some candy, and hey, happy Halloween.
It's one of the things and it's funny that because we talked about it, I think, a little bit on our trip here, but it's always been one of the things I was most envious about you and wish it was one of the personality traits that I could have more, that I could have this kind of devil may care. I've talked about it multiple times on the show, but like even in parenting, like I have these moments where I have to fight this voice in my head that tells me like, oh, is this the right thing? Are you doing the right thing? You know, and I called you. I go, how did you get over these like neurotic moments? Apparently, and you're like, what do you mean? I go, did you ever have these doubts that you thought what you were doing was wrong? And no, not at all. Oh, fuck. But so it's funny to me that you and I are so much alike. But in this, as much as I would like, there's a little view in me that I would love to sit out here in my new neighborhood and scare the, like, just because we have just cutesy decorations that we got from you and mom and just scare the shit out of some kids. And not really, for me, it wouldn't necessarily be for the joy. It's really weird. Not for the joy of watching that 8-year-old princess cry, but the nostalgia that it would bring back in my child. You know what I mean? That it's like I'm carrying on your tradition. I'm scaring little princess.
But see, the only thing that's really stopping you from doing that is the repercussions of everybody. And I truly think that's sad.
Yeah.
You know,
it is.
You're taking away something from that child in that process.
Well, and really what I think the issue really is that it's like if I had a kid that I thought would be afraid, well, then I would just, like what we do. We just walk around that house. So Jacob would be like, oh, let's go up there. And I'm like, well, that's kind of scary. We could go there when you get a little older. Or if he really pushes the issue, I'm like, go nuts. Like if I go, you understand it's fake? He's like, yeah. I go let him scare the shit out of you. Who cares? You know, And if he cries, I would deal with it. It's the entitlement of the idea of saying that, well, now no one could do it because of my personal opinion. You know what I mean? Like, I always liken it to there was a young lady that lived in the apartment building I used to manage, and she had a tremendous fear of spiders. And so she would call me if there was a spider web outside her door and, like, the light in the hallway or whatever, and I would go and I'd clear it out. No big deal. But at one point, she said, well, they're really bad in the summer. And I said, well, all bugs are bad in the summer. Right. And she goes, well, I would like to have my apartment fumigated every month during the summer months. And the reality of it was that we did have 6, like, calls that we could have in a month, and we rarely used them. But I was like, I explained it to her. I said, while I can understand that you have a fear, and I apologize if this seems insensitive to that fear, but it is not the owner's responsibility to deal with your fear. And that's what I would wish that everybody could get on board with, and maybe I'm asking you, how do we get that into kids so we could turn this around, is that I would like for her to understand, oh, I have a fear that is abnormal, not necessarily abnormal in the sense that it's deserving of ridicule, but it's not everybody else's responsibility.
Well, it's abnormal in the point that you don't understand the fear because you don't have it.
Right.
But why does she have to project her fear
and make it my problem? Make
it,
you know what I mean? And so, because if I had a tremendous fear of spiders, I like to think that I would be like, oh my God, I would not, I'll just take care of it because it's not, I wouldn't want to put them out for whatever I was.
Well, there is a process you can go through to get rid of that fear. When I was young, I mean, like 5 years old, we had an aunt that came and stayed with us. She was deadly afraid of crickets. So I could catch a cricket shove it at her, chase her around the house. She'd run to the bathroom, so upset and hysterical, lock herself in there, and it'd take 15 minutes for her to calm down enough to unlock the door. It was hilarious.
How old were you?
5. Jesus, and she's just like panting like a mad woman. It was, but it it took almost a month and a half of that.
How old was she?
She was 30, 32, something right around in there.
Now, this is, I just love that all this is coming up in the context of we started this off talking about you scaring the shit out of 8-year-olds. You know what I mean?
To adults.
I just, and it's, the listeners don't know this. Part of the reason why I think this is so funny, and people have listened to the show for since like the very beginning with Bill may have heard this already, but I have seen countless times family slides of my father as a child, like, laughing while he's tugging on the ears of a puppy. And it's very interesting because your actions and the funny anecdotes of your life make you seem like the heart like a heartless bastard, which, again, is kind of a reoccurring theme that it kept coming up during this trip while we were talking and reflecting on Grandpa and me being a dad, blah, blah, blah. And but in all actuality, you're not. Like you said, you're like, you know, these people that are accusing you of being a dick, you've been more helpful and in a sense of a charitable help, not necessarily giving to leukemia research, but like helping people that are hard on times and need a helping hand or a leg up. Like you'll give the time and you'll invest.
I will help anybody that's trying to help themselves.
Right.
I'm not going to do it all.
So, but to get back to what you were saying, is that so you at 5 years old, though, found sheer joy in chasing around a grown-ass woman.
With a grown-ass woman. She would run in the bathroom, lock the door, be so hysterical, she couldn't even get out of the bathroom for 10 or 15 minutes. And it was fun. But the process over about a month and a half, she became less fearful of it, so it wasn't fun anymore.
Yeah.
We couldn't chase her around. And she wouldn't run as fast.
So in a lot of ways, you had a...
I cured her.
You cured her. Well done, yeah. Father. Yeah. See? And there we go. So everybody...
You just got to go through the process.
And that's... I honestly do believe that. Like, I showed an episode... I showed the pilot episode of The Walking Dead to Jacob because he really wanted to see it. Like, he called it my zombie show. And, like, he saw commercials for it. And he likes the idea that he likes scary movies. He likes it because he likes the reaction that it gets from other adults. When they hear me talk about it in front of him, like, I could tell that he's like...
But see, most people like that reaction from people that are just hysterical, scared, shitless.
Right.
I mean...
And the only reason I do it is because I've seen people who have had multiple people, not just a person, multiple people who have had the villain songs or the villain parts of Disney movies fast-forwarded in their childhood. And these are people that, in my opinion, have a hard time grasping and wrestling with the... some of the harsher realities of the real world. And it's clearly we're not going to deal with a zombie apocalypse or something, but I do think on some small scale, there are miniature zombie apocalypses that happen within our day-to-day lives. And that if you are a person who is hypersensitive to the known awareness that this is fake and it's latex and chocolate syrup or carrot syrup with food color, you know what I mean? And it freaks you out. Then there's got to be some form of you getting a mistake on your utility bill and you just lose your shit. You know what I mean? You fucking crumble. Exactly. And so that's why, to me, I'm okay with showing him The Walking Dead. And if he has nightmares, I was ready to deal with it and know that that was my fault. It's my responsibility. But in actuality, he lost interest in it about because it's a slow-moving show.
Well, slow-moving.
And then wife said recently, he asked if zombies were real. With her.
Right.
And so she kind of was like, maybe we stay away from that for a while. And I said, I'm only going to stay away from it because he's lost interest. I'm not going to also cram it down his throat. But if the kid says, I want to watch it, I'm not going to keep it from him.
But he likes to be scared. But at the same point, he can check back to reality. He knows it's only a movie.
Right.
That's makeup. That's latex.
Right.
It's not real.
And he gets to enjoy it for what it's intent.
Right. But he goes back to reality.
Right.
That's not real. That was just there. To get my reaction and to frighten me.
Right. Well,
period.
Now, and we'll use this to kind of transition back into Grandpa because I think it's funny. My grandfather was notorious for anytime you went to the bathroom in his house, there was like an L turn that you would have to take to get to the restroom. And as soon as he saw you get up, I imagine he would count to a 10 Mississippi of some kind. He would get up, get down on all fours, wait for you to come around that corner and just go and crawl at you like a little bulldog. A redneck bulldog is what he was.
And it was a dimly lit hallway because he did not allow you to turn on the lights.
That's right.
He had a little 7-watt bulb down in the corner of this thing that gave you enough of a glow that you could feel along with your toes to get back out. And it was a waste of money if you turned on that light, so you had to go by the glow.
And so what comes of that when you laugh about that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? Because it happens. You scream, and then he laughs, and he can barely breathe. There were times that he never – I mean, maybe he smoked when he was younger, but he had that laugh like I have, and you have it too, you know, like he just
– because it is just such an emotional, physical laugh. I mean, he just – he couldn't everything breathe. Went into it.
Yeah.
Everything.
And he would buckle over – And then we would all laugh about it, but he just got the biggest kick out of this. Now, so what that means when that's kind of like an influence you have as a child, and then on top of that, you being his son. I mean, I remember when Natalie and I were married and we lived with you guys for like 6 months, 8 months, whatever it was before we got the house. And I went out just to toss a towel. And my childhood scaring days are long gone in my brain. The house is completely pitch black. And I know now. I know now because I have children. I have my own house.
You got two targets.
And you're not thinking about it all day. You're just like...
But it pops in your mind.
It's just you walk in, you go, oh, it's dark. And then you kind of hear a rustling in the garage, I imagine. You go, oh, he's out there. Oh, this is going to be fucking good. And you drop to all fours, like, real quick. So we had this kitchen that was U-shaped, and it was the dining room. If you're standing at the kitchen sink and looking, there's some cabinets, and that was the walkway across to the bedrooms. And there was a counter to your left, the fridge, and some other counters and cabinets were to the right. And you'd walk from the garage that was on the other side of the counter to your left, walk about 6 or 7 feet, hang a right, and it was all pitch black. I was putting a towel in something or whatever. And you were doing the all fours. And I tried to climb as a fucking mid-20s man, supposedly, until this fucking moment, tried to climb up these cabinets backwards, screaming like a little girl, and it almost killed you. Then we both were laughing. Like, and it's funny. You kind of have this moment of like, damn it, he got me good. And that's really funny. But damn it, why did I have to like, I literally... like that, you know what I mean? Like,
I did that to your mom,
right? Yeah,
but I was in the office, and the hallway was dark, and she's, you know, going down to go to bed or whatever she was doing, and I come out,
yeah,
on all fours. She didn't even look at me, didn't even know what it was, ran in your sister's bedroom, jumped up on the bed, screaming and dancing. I mean, this went on for almost a minute before she calmed down, and then it became even more hilarious. But yeah, that's
you're right. It is
do.
Funny because I can imagine that idea when you said didn't even look at you because
no, she didn't
even
know what it was.
You get that person at their animal brain, like at their most basic
because of that sound.
Yeah,
and it's like, I mean, where is that going to come from in real life? No. There's nothing to relate to that sound to either human or animal. And you lose it.
Because
the aliens are coming and we're all head.
Like, even Grandpa's like, yeah. it's like, that sounds like an angry chihuahua is what it would sound like, you know, with on a few steroids. Like,
but it's just an angry noise that you cannot relate to.
Yeah.
There's nothing your brain can snap to and go,
oh, damn,
that's what it was. It was a chihuahua.
Oh, it's so funny. So, So let's talk about the trip a little bit because I think it is a funny kind of transition. So what we did was we went on this motorcycle trip. This was your idea. You said
this was my idea.
Probably a few months, I think, or maybe a few weeks after Grandpa had passed away.
No, it was actually basically the same day, maybe a day after. It was very, very quick.
Okay. And so you had this idea of going, you and I going on a motorcycle trip.
Correct.
And you said that there was a stretch of freeway or highway and the river that in New Mexico that he had talked about and mentioned.
He had talked about, but I really did not understand what the significant meaning of it was. And it was a couple of different things. He had no funeral service. He didn't want that. So this trip was like closure for me. Closure for his family and stuff in Texas that, you know, there was no funeral to go to.
Because they came out, but it is kind of a weird
thing. Well, they came out in May. You know, But, you know, traditionally to them, there's a funeral, gravesites, all this stuff's going on.
On an interesting side note, what I always thought was funny is that these are the relatives. They never flew from Plains, Texas. It's
well,
about...
No, they flew, but they don't like it. It's too much of a hassle.
Well, okay, the trips, I guess I'm saying, that I knew that they were coming,
right.
That they would much prefer driving.
Correct.
The what I now know to be about 1,400 miles.
One way.
Yeah. And what they would always do is they would pack nice funeral clothes in case somebody died.
That was my cousin.
On the way.
Yeah, that's my cousin. Her and her husband travel with funeral clothes just in case somebody dies and the funeral is on their way home.
Now, I'm not...
So they can cut short vacation
right.
And go straight to the funeral.
Now, what I love... I'm not laughing because I want to make it clear.
Oh, I was laughing. And when I asked them what was in the trunk and they told me, I just... busted up.
Well, because here's the thing. It is funny, but I'm not laughing because I think it's stupid. Like, I want to make that clear. I'm laughing because I like that brain. You know what I mean? I like the idea of like, okay, we got the toothbrush. I got my razor. Honey, we should probably bring some funeral clothes, right?
We got to get the funeral clothes.
Why would we do that? Somebody could die. We're in the air for 18 hours or the car for 18 hours. I mean, come on. Solid point, honey. Go ahead and throw in my shirt and my bolo tie, you know?
Bolo tie was part of it.
Right. Because they're
funeral
taxes.
Boots, pants, coat,
funeral boots.
And a bolo.
So here's the thing. So we go back on this trip, and we left on Monday, probably about what? Six in the morning?
6:30 in the morning we got out of here.
And we were driving. It's interesting. What I learned is that I've driven for like 6 or 7 hours in a car. And you kind of have that nod off thing that you might occasionally do. You're like, fuck, and you got to get some coffee or
a whole different deal
Red
on
Bull.
A motorcycle.
But on a motorcycle, you are fucking awake.
You're wired.
It was the closest to a Coke bender I think I could ever have come.
You sleep, you die.
Yeah, like you, and you never feel tired. You never even.
No, because you're always on alert.
Yeah. But I never felt scared, really.
Well,
I mean, initially there were some times.
It's not a thing of scared, but you're always on alert. Your eyes are scanning.
Mm-hmm.
Your muscles are tensed in a balancing.
Ah, the balance. That's it. That's what it is.
You, in a car, you can just sit there and melt.
Yeah, you're in a chair, literally.
You fall asleep and run off the road or whatever.
That's a good point. So we went from essentially from Burbank down to Anaheim, from Anaheim to Tucson, and we were stopping about every 150 to 175 miles to refuel.
To fuel up.
It took us, we left at 6 a.m. We got into there at 8:30 is when we
8:30 into
Tucson. And then we went on from Tucson all the way to Plains, Texas the next day. And we stopped off. This is what I thought was kind of it was a fun thing and something that I wasn't prepared for. But the kind of this trip for me was I was very passive in the whole thing and that it was a thing that it was your idea. You asked me to come along with you as, you know, and so I'm like, yeah, sure. And it was fun. And what I kind of thought is like, well, everything to me always has to have a purpose. You know what I mean? Like it's kind of a waste of energy if I just sit there and zone out. But so I spent a lot of time thinking about Grandpa and his influences and on me and his and what his life meant. And what I kind of was extrapolating out of that was that it kind of made me think Grandpa, while he was a happy man and a content man, even at the end of his life, I mean, he literally said the phrase, and I just had this thought pop into my head. I really hope that for anybody who's sitting there listening, I really don't want the intent of this to be sad in tone. Like, I could ask you to kind of wash that out of your brain, because there is no real sadness to it. And I don't want to, like, I just realized we start off talking, oh, it's so funny, all these crazy things that I learned. So Grandpa passed away. Like, you know what I mean?
But you have to look at him. He would have enjoyed the trip. And this trip was a lot of different things. He had motorcycles up until the time that he was probably 52, 53 years old and gave up on it. I'd had motorcycles and everything for years, too. But he never got the opportunity to do a long-distance ride because of kids, wife, and a lot of different things. So he never had the motorcycle to do it. So after I had my Gold Wing, he really got into sort of living it through me.
So you would do the fun run, which is, for those who don't know, you would go on Route 66,
Route 66
every May.
Yeah, in Arizona.
And he did it for a few years until you started taking Tyler, my nephew, and,
right.
and you
did
started
it on,
going in a car.
Did it on motorcycles for about 4 years and then started taking the car because of the grandson going. But he was always in thrilled by that and very inquisitive. So it was a lot, like I said, a lot of different things. It was for the relatives there. Primarily is for me. It was the experience of going with you on a bike ride. You had never experienced it. It was a time of silence and riding across the country to just think of him and what he meant to my life, what he meant to your life. It was just a period of reflection.
Right.
And it was a raw idea, but more or less it was made up as we went along. There was no set schedule.
Yeah, it wasn't
anything.
You knew the mileage between major cities, and we would hit, once we hit 150 miles, we knew we could only go 50 more than the next gas station we hit. It was for on my end, it was really interesting and a lot of fun, and it kind of it was, I think, more about me until we hit the Truth or Consequences, and it was funny because you had said that was the area near the Rio Grande River that he had kind of mentioned.
Elephant Butte and Truth of Consequences on the Rio Grande there on that 25 was the information that him and I had shared in 2005. And I never got any more information out of him. So, I mean, this was just something that he attempted to do on that last trip to Texas for him. Never completed it, never pulled it off.
Yeah, and so what he said, well, Dad told me, he goes, well, we're going to drive through this city, and if you see anything that you think would make sense to him or whatever, and it was kind of, I don't know, it was cool. I really thought it was interesting to
crawl back in his mind.
Right, and I'm going to say something, and I think I'm going to speak a little bit out of school, but I really do think that within our family, there has been a reaction that was very not understanding of who Grandpa was. I guess that's fair to say. And so that's what I really like the most about that little moment within the trip is that you and I were both sitting there going, what was he thinking? Why this? Why that? And we had a map and we were, you know, trying to look at it from what he would have done. And it was also really cool to see that, you know, well, we know what we would have done, but it's
right,
very
but you
different.
Couldn't, you couldn't think that way.
Right. You had to think of what he would have done. And so I started looking on my phone when we got to this town because I knew he was a big fan of Westerns and stuff. And so I looked in like a Wikipedia entry about Truth or Consequences. And so I learned all this little trivia about the town and that it's called Truth or Consequences because there was an NBC show that was on a radio show and then became a television show that Bob Barker used to host before Price is Right. And it was like a quiz show / stunt show kind of thing. And the original host of the show on the radio and on television put out this challenge and said, the first town to name their town after the show Truth or Consequences, they will come and do a show there. And so this Hot Springs, New Mexico, was the first one to do it. And so I think in 1954 is what it said, if I remember, they changed it to Truth or Consequences, and now it's Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. And so there was no real Westerns. There was Westerns that mentioned the Rio Grande, and there's that one that he was a big John Wayne fan, and I remember looking at it. There was a Rio Grande
River.
There was a Western.
Rio Grande Western, yeah.
Yeah, there was with John Wayne. I'm like, oh, this is it, you know. But I look, and it says it was shot in, like, northern Nevada and some parts of Utah, nowhere near the Rio Grande River.
Right.
And I thought, do you think he would have thought that it was shot here? And he was like, and you were like, no, he wouldn't have even thought about that. And so then it was what I love the most is that what started off in my mind, I don't know about you, but in my mind is this little trip that was like, it's almost like that that movie, Very Close and Incredibly Loud and Very, or whatever, the Tom Hanks where he dies and he was always sending his kid on these treasure hunts or whatever, that I was looking for this very huge, significant moment. Like all of a sudden my grandfather would divulge the meaning of life.
He
from
would appear
the,
before
yeah,
us.
Exactly. Like Obi-Wan Kenobi or some bullshit.
Please tell us, Dad, why are we here?
Yeah. Or even bigger, like, just help me find peace throughout the rest of my life because there's some little trick, like he hit a rock underneath the bench. You know, some bullshit like that. But then what I love about it was that what actually came about is that you told me that he was actually coming back, planned to camp there. And Grandma said he pulled in and was like, nah, screw it. He just left and went on his merry way.
He was always, I mean, he liked to do different things or whatever, but he wanted to know what it was before he really got into it. He wasn't a huge question asker, directions or anything like that. And if it look too complicated to him, he would just say to hell with it and move on.
So what we figured out was is that there was a stretch of freeway, the Interstate 25, that would have run as a way that he could come back from Plains and visiting family.
Right.
There, next to the Rio Grande River, there were two major campgrounds that were right off the freeway.
And he had planned to take the trailer with him that year, and then that backfired.
Backfired on him. And that what I also like about it is that we knew that he wanted to camp on the Rio Grande River. And then to me, for lack of a better way of putting it, the nail in the coffin was that it made perfect sense for him to want to camp on the Rio Grande River, that there was this campground here in Elephant Butte that he had also mentioned. And then you said keep an eye out. And I just happened to see a Church of Christ, which is the church that they go to. Like they have, for the listeners, they have a very specific, like most people,
conservative church.
It's a very specific conservative church. And if they just happen to pop in to say hey to Jesus in any other church, that would be blasphemy. And
yes.
So anyway, but you didn't see that church. And so.
Yeah, I was looking for something else because, well, you have to look at it. I don't associate my father with that church.
Right.
And that, I think, is the biggest two perspectives of my father within the family. The rest of them see him and his connection with the church, but that's not my perspective.
You knew him as the guy who would tell you to go break the chicken feeder or whatever.
Well, I had to go break down equipment or something, so, you know, hey, it's broke.
We got
to
fix it.
Him and I are going to have to stay here and fix it. You
guys
and the others go on to church. Say hi to Jesus for me. So, and I knew him in a totally different realm than the rest of them. So I wasn't looking for that. I was looking for something else that would just...
Well, and for me, just because I know of it, and it's funny because anytime I see a Church of Christ, there's one near my house.
Right.
It sticks out. It's like that thing when you look to buy a Volkswagen, all of a sudden you start seeing them pop up everywhere kind of thing.
Well, that's the whole thing that makes it so funny to me. Here we are in this little park in the middle of town. We got iPhones out. We're searching the internet. We're all coming up with all this. When it all comes down to it, he was trying to appease my mother by having a church nearby that they could go to, that they could stay for a couple of days.
And do what he wanted to do.
Do what he wanted to do, but yet still appease her by having a church for her to go to.
Which I think is cool. I mean, to me, I think it's great that he... One of the things that I said in this little kind of quote-unquote goodbye video that I sent to them, essentially, because I didn't want to be like, hey, Grandpa, I know you're dying, so here's this video. But was that their relationship, to me, has always been a great model for my own marriage. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I really think he was kind of that old-school guy that, in a lot of ways, I wish I could be. I'm not very good at necessarily appeasing or finding ways
to... That old-school and everything in his relationship with her. And it's the same thing when you say other people would look at me and the things I do, that I'm a cold-hearted bastard. And he would do the same things, and maybe they thought he was heartless, but he had a very kind and giving side of him and everything outside of all that. So, I mean, you had to really sort of look into him deeply to really figure out what made him tick.
And so what happened was is we decided, we said, well, here's what makes sense. If you look at this whole stretch of freeway that goes along the Rio Grande River that he would have traveled, because I asked you, I go, he wouldn't have gone off where he was already going to be traveling to find a campground. And you're like, no, that was not him.
No.
And so I said, if I'm looking at this map through his eyes, I'm like, here is two spots in what is a major city. So it's not like I can't go to a grocery store if I need something, or it's very convenient. But at the same time, I could camp next to a river, which is something he could never do in California.
No.
There was no real campground. This was kind of woods and desert and beautiful scenery. Also by this Rio Grande River, which is a kind of a landmark in westerns and, you know,
he was always interested in the Rio Grande, either through movies and stuff.
Right.
It was a part of Texas. It was a big part of all of his life.
And so you said, well, I guess he could come here but what I thought was interesting is when we were kind of narrowing this down, you said that you go, well, I guess he could come here, but you go, then I don't know where he would go to church. And I was like, no, there's a church just not four blocks from here. And you're like, oh, there was? I said, yeah. And you're like, well, then that must be it. And so we just narrowed it down. We said, well, let's go look at these two campgrounds to see which one's next to the river. And we found this Elephant Butte. And so we scattered some of his ashes there. And then we continued on. Now, this is what I thought was really cool. And in the And the meat and potatoes of the trip for me was that we got to go back, and these are relatives that I personally haven't seen in 30 years.
Haven't seen it in their world in 30 years.
That's true. They came and seen me at a comedy show. They came and saw me in Midland, Odessa, like maybe 6 years ago,
well,
5 years ago.
They visited in California.
Right, right. But I was a child. And this is very different when I'm a grown up and I go there and I remember all these people and I know them and think of them fondly, but it's different when you get to see them through the eyes of an adult and you're almost a peer to them. Like when you're in your mid 30s and you have two children, it's like, oh, I'm playing the same game you guys are, kind of thing. I mean, I'm not where you are in your life. I mean, you're still 20 years ahead of me or more, but anyway, what was really cool about it was we went there, and one of the things you wanted to do was take some of his ashes and scatter them at the farm where he grew up.
Side of the house and everything where he grew up as a child.
Right. And so we got my great uncle, your uncle, he came, right. And he's the oldest child. And
he's the oldest out of his family.
And he spent his entire life farming. My grandpa came out and was a chicken farmer in California and then eventually became like a truck driver and stuff and got out of farming.
Right. Well, he never really wanted to be in farming. And he got us out of the country because he didn't want us to get into farming. He wanted us to have other opportunities. Mm. So that's why we left that little ranch and everything down there in Turlock and moved to Modesto.
And so for me, getting it, you know, growing up my entire life, the product of that decision, which it's a very interesting thing to me in that here I am looking at relatives that are directly related to my grandfather. It's not like, you know what I mean? It's not like, I mean, they're cousins, but it's not like third, fourth cousins, you know, like it's, and they're people that I kind of grew up with.
Immediate family.
Right. And they have made their living continuing on the legacy of their parents in the same little plot of land in Texas. And that.
Well, that uncle you speak of was born on that parcel of land. He's spent his entire life in that same county.
Right.
Never moved. He's got a daughter now and a granddaughter that have never left that region of Texas.
Right.
Never.
And to some people, this is what I thought was interesting, is that to some people and things that you might see in movies, it's like, oh, look, that's so sad. But when you kind of, and you and I kept talking about it, when you go there and you see it, there's a romanticism to it. There's a
huge.
It's a weird thing to watch these people who have flat panel big screen TVs, but from my perspective, and I know it's an ignorant one in case Edith and Randy ever hear this, but from my perspective, there's a heartland aspect to what they're doing. There's a settler, homestead vibe to it that
it's pure.
Yes. And that these are people that they make their living by, you know, tilling soil, and every country song you ever heard, you know what I mean, is personified in these people. And I feel like such a fucking jackass saying that. But when you're there, it's the closest thing to I felt like what it might be to fall into a cult. You know what I mean? Like where it's like you just kind of get overwhelmed. And for me, we went by the gravesite of C.B. Worsham, who was my great-great-grandfather.
Yeah.
Oh, third grade?
He was my great-grand.
My great-grandfather's Thurlow. And right. So, yeah, see, my great-great-grandfather. And I'm looking at his tombstone, his wife, and there was, you know, you see he had a wife who only made it to about 30, 40, and then he got married again, and you get to hear all these stories, and you get to see a little bit of a picture, and you start realizing that this dude was born in 1875. 73, I apologize. His wife was born in 75.
Basically a decade after Lincoln was assassinated.
Yeah.
When you put it in that.
Right. That's what's so weird. And my grandfather hung out with him as a child.
Right.
I know that there's moments on this show that like a Joseph Bears will make fun of me because when I talk to the family therapist, like, yeah, no shit, men and women are different. And I feel like this might sound like one of those moments, but I'm really trying to find the words to impress upon someone that it is kind of mind blowing. And it's a thing where you sit there and you kind of you can't help but go, man, I would like to do this. I would like to come back here and check all this stuff out. And just, you know, your cousins, Edith and Rand. Edith is your cousin. That's right. William's daughter. And her husband are, now their daughter's grown up and she has her own family and right. She lives about 30 minutes away or whatever. But they have a farm that they take care of together. They don't have a ranch hand. It's just two people. Right. And they work their asses off, as you said, on a three-month cycle. But they always get to be with each other. And while many of us who are married cannot fathom that, me personally, I would really enjoy that. Like, I've always kind of strived and tried to find a way to work where Natalie and I could work together on things and be around each other. Because I thoroughly like... I know that I'm happier when she's there with me, kind of thing. It's one of the reasons why I keep pushing you guys to pay $2 for this, is so I don't have to travel when I leave home. But anyway, I hope I'm explaining it in the way that I intended when I was feeling it. Is that you mix all this in, you mix all this history and this family stuff and getting to hear all these stories about how they grew up. And then on top of that, for me to literally have a 5-year-old and hear a story about my grandfather pushing a knife plow and having to plow fields and then plant them. And then I'm listening to a man and I'm like, I asked him, I said, well, what did your father do when you, because I guess he had a story where my grandpa could barely hold it down. And then,
well, because he was so light, because this was a 2-row knifing plow. And
so it would do so two rows of what you would see in a farm, those little aisleways.
Yeah,
and
so it was like 36, 40 inches wide. Well, it required the weight of a person riding on it to sink it down and knife into the dirt. So he was barely heavy enough to make
this thing. They had to put something on there, too.
They could have. But, I mean, it was designed for a full-grown man to sit on and do this. So here's a little light guy trying to do it, and this thing's bouncing all over, and... So it was difficult, and you had to do this in a straight line. You couldn't be wandering all over, and then you'd have to get to the end of their property, turn it around, line it up to that other row, and go back the other way.
And so
over and over until you covered all this land.
William said, "I said, how many times did you have to screw up before you figured that out? Like figured out how to do that?" And what was really interesting for me is he kind of looked at it. He kind of was like, I don't think we ever did. Like you didn't screw up. And it wasn't that he was perfect. And here's what I took out of it is that he said, well, one time when he first started, like he spooked the mules. And so I had to go chase him down because he was too little. He couldn't go get him back. So you just bring the mules back and you go. And here's why I think it's interesting and worth bringing up on this particular show is that these are two children that were raised and this was what was expected of them. They didn't have to, nobody was worried about their egos. Nobody was worried about how they were being stimulated and if Mozart was being played to their womb. And yet these men grew up to be, men of integrity, successful men financially and emotionally, have very fulfilling marriages and relationships with their children, no different than any of us. And so that's what was eye-opening for me. And when I said, so you never had a moment where your father came back and saw what you did and say, yelled at you. And he was like, no, I didn't. He goes, and I'm sure, he goes, I don't know how good of a job we did. You know what I mean? Like, it could have been bad. And so it's just all that, I really feel like I'm not articulating this well enough. Is that...
Well, but you said it in you said that was expected of them.
Right.
They weren't asked.
Right.
Can you do this for me or whatever?
Yeah.
They were just told this was expected to them of them because this was family income. They were going to sell this crop, make some money to get by for the next year. So it wasn't a thought of I'm going to screw up. I got to go out here and get this done, make it work.
Right. And I just look at it and I like what I can't help but see it through my eyes is that if I'm 5 years old and the horses grow, I just want to buckle emotionally. And I don't know, maybe. But hearing him tell the story, the man who lived it, looking at his little brother going through this, there wasn't that. There was no, like, oh, it was just like, well, shit, that happened.
It was just another thing during the day.
Right. So now we're going to go back and we just pick up. And so it's going to take us a little longer. Who cares? We're going to be doing this whether it's done early or not. Like, it, you know, it's just because it has to be done.
But see, you have to, like, again, it was expected of them. And you're trying to compare it to Jacob. It's not really real in that perspective because at that age, they knew, you know, the family needed this, and this to survive. Jacob only knows that you get a checkbook, you run down to Rouse.
Right.
And you got food.
Yes.
This was not the case for them. This was their reality. So they knew certain processes had to be done for them to survive. And they're there by themselves with their mother while their father's out working in the oil fields trying to scrape enough money to get through the Depression.
Right.
So you just don't have that kind of reality for children today like you did before.
Right.
It doesn't even come close.
There's no way. And hearing what I really liked is that last night that we had, we went over to William's house and you were asking all the questions and he actually laid out like plots. And I just liked that they kept saying acres and sections like it was something that should make sense. And he did this thing when we posed for a picture. You wanted to get a picture of me, William, and you kind of near where their house was. Right. And he just reached down and he picked up and crumpled the leaves or whatever and jokingly said, that's about time to cut. It had already been cut and harvested. But they had this thing called maize for anybody who doesn't know. And it's something that my family's farm grows and it's just cow feed. And that's how they support and pay their bills. They also grow peanuts and cotton. And I learned a shit ton about farming and it was just really fucking interesting to me. And there's these things where it's like watching in a world of emails and Blackberries, watching a man who was born pre-Great Depression and that you grew up with as a child crumple a leaf and have that say something to him. You know what I mean? Like there's just something kind of surreal about that aspect or about that little context, that moment, if you would. And then watching Randy, like he took a piece of maize and like kind of was chewing on it. He's like, yeah, it's about ready. And then, and he told me, I was like, cause he's saying that, well, we need more rain, you know? And I don't know if every farmer says that or what, but in my mind, I'm like, well, we live in a world of on demand. Like, why not just sell what you have here and go find a place that rains more?
Cause it's constantly changing.
Well, what he said was is that if you moved 100 miles north,
he wouldn't know,
know what to do. Because, like what you just described, your Uncle William spent his entire life on that farm, on that land, never left the county, and that's what he knows. Probably doesn't look back at his life and go, I hated it. I wish I could have gone to the Grand Tetons or whatever.
It was what he was meant to do.
And that's what he enjoyed and made a very good living for himself and his family. And there's this process to it, too, that I thought was really interesting is that – so. Great-great-grandpa CB had this plot of land that he traded for his land in Arkansas. Like, it was a direct trade.
Sight unseen,
which in a world where you can't email, like, I don't know how they, like, that's what I love, too, is William goes, I don't even know how they found each other, but they did. And he said, Dad told me that when his grandfather, this is William's grandfather who came out and started this whole thing for our family.
Well, he traded his property in Arkansas for this section. It wasn't a complete section. Now, a section of land is a square mile, 360 acres. He purchased 200 of that. There was already 280 acre parcels or 160 acres that was owned by other individuals. So he only got the 200 of it. So that's what he traded for. So they loaded up everything that they owned
in a train cart
into a train car in Arkansas. Rode with their possessions on the train car to Brownsfield, which is about 30, 35 miles.
Driving in a car that can go 65 miles an hour.
But, you know, that's...
And this is a time of buggies.
Yeah, well, and then they hitched up and everything and wagons and stuff and carted all their stuff. Had unloaded off the train in Brownsfield. Right. And then make their way out to where this property was.
And what I love is that after all of this, William said that his dad told him, Dad said that when they got there, his dad said, if I had enough money, I would have gone back.
I would go right back.
Like, couldn't they just show up and go, well, fuck. Like,
we're here?
And here's what I love about this, is that what comes out of this well, fuck moment is a crazy, almost 100-year history of people. Like, it was really interesting for me to look at his tombstone. I don't know if I said this already on the show, but look at his tombstone and realize... This guy has no fucking clue who I am. And not from a narcissistic standpoint, but in a big picture standpoint. To give us an idea in a world where we wake up, and there's a reason why I keep mentioning all this stuff. And it also, I think, ties back to last week's episode where we talk about my new hero, Tom, and that you were on this planet for such a small amount of time in the bigger picture of things.
Minuscule.
You know what I mean? And so I hope that I could take this, much to the demise of my comedy career. I hope I could take this trip and this moment and all this reflection and family history and go, maybe you should fucking lighten up a little bit. Maybe shit's not that bad. You know what I mean?
No.
Maybe you should just kind of, I mean, maybe just get angry at things to make them funny and not for real. You know what I mean? So what, your fucking kid literally knocked over a plate? Like, is it really worth, you know, fucking going nuts? And I don't know. I mean, I think it's a little silly for me to take it that far, but I think it's a little bit of perspective that was nice and refreshing, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I think some of the stuff is to really get angry about is not so much the little plate or whatever, but you take them back then. There was such an independence. There was such a freedom that we've sold off now.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that. We depend on things. We depend on a job. We depend on money. We depend on government. They were individuals, totally free, independent. They didn't depend on anything but that family unit, putting in that crop, taking it out, and trading it for a life.
And hearing Helen talk about things like fried pies and who's good and getting
fried
a recipe of
stuff.
Cornbread. And
yeah.
It's very odd to me. I mean, I knew these people as a child, and I always liked watching Helen talk because of the way she held her eyebrows and the tone of her voice. And I liked William just because of the look. He's always had these humongous fucking ears. And I'm talking about this through the mind of a 6-7-year-old boy who's looking at these people who come by every once in a while. And I knew who they were. And I always thought it was cool that they were from Texas. You know what I mean? That there was a cowboy element. And I knew that they were farmers. But I honestly also thought that they were farmers, but they were modern day farmers where they just kind of held the land and then they hired people to drive tractors and stuff. And
no,
fuck that. They were out there doing it. Like, doing the shit. And the other thing I think I want to say too before we start to wrap this up is that what I thought was really interesting is that there is a cycle that is inevitable within that lifestyle. And that so CB starts with a section of land, okay? And then he passes away and he has 5 children, whatever it is. That section of land gets divvied up amongst those 5 children. Mm-hmm. And then they start farming their little plot of that original section of land. And while they're farming it, their goal and only way of really survival is to try and purchase more land to be able to farm and make more money to sustain themselves.
Correct.
And then they pass away, and then their chunk of land gets divvied up amongst however many kids that they,
that
have. And you know, and
the
so
pie just keeps getting sliced,
right? And so, and people come in, like there's a family that is not related to us or connected to us at all that owns the land.
Couple of different sites. It's like grave sites or whatever.
Yeah. They own a chunk of that original section because somebody passed away and I think didn't have any kids or something that wanted
right.
Or no, kids didn't want it, so they sold it because they weren't farmers themselves.
Right.
That's what it was. And so you just kind of, you keep growing and accruing all this land and then sooner or later, it's like all of a sudden you're like, shit, I'm doing all right. Like, you know what I mean? Eventually it works down to where one generation, if they're smart about it and can stay connected as a family, people can, you know, be very, very wealthy, like unbelievably wealthy.
Well, it's like my uncle. He owns two complete sections and another 2 or 3 80 to 160 acre parcels. So in essence, he doesn't farm anymore, but that's his retirement because
he rents that out to other farmers who work the land
with other farmers.
Yeah.
And then he collects off of their yield.
And so he that's his Social Security because he's been self-employed. He's never.
Well, but he gets Social Security, paid in Social Security taxes, but that land is like my rentals.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the whole thing.
Yeah, it's I don't know. So that
and it becomes quite a prideful thing to be a landowner and keep it
right.
And it's very, very important to him that this parcel land here on the family's first section stays within the family. And was very upset. He was offered my grandfather's parcel years ago when he first started farming, decided he could not really afford it at that time. It was sold then to my grandfather's sister, and he to this day hates it that he doesn't own his father's 80 acres.
Yeah.
just drives him nuts.
And it's and that's such an interesting thing that I think is, I think for overall, it is gone. Like, you know what I mean? I know that there are father-son business that get passed on and you hear about the generational thing. And it's, I don't know, it's just, I kept thinking about, I was listening to Adam Kroll's podcast and he made a comment about how he's got guys that help him build houses and work on houses. Right. And he said they don't make as much money as, say, the guys that work in the office for him, but they're happier. They're satisfied because they get to look back and go, this is what I built. We hung sheetrock today. We did this today or whatever. And that was what I think is part of the romanticism of me walking around and them showing me how they harvest peanuts and how you know when it's time to take the maize down and why you need a frost. And that when it's time to harvest the cotton, they have to hit it with like a poison to kill the actual foliage.
Well, they either have to hit it with poison or wait till the freeze
so the foliage dies, and then it's easier for the combine to separate the cotton from the leaf and the stem and all that stuff.
You have to get the moisture out of the plant before you can harvest it.
And crazy interesting stuff that if they harvest it too early, that there's too much moisture content in the cotton, in the maize, and that when they pack it together in this huge like truck trailer size bale, that it sits in the sun, and because it's essentially a ginormous fucking comforter, that actually the water in the center gets so hot that it'll actually catch on fire from the inside.
Water from mold created.
Yeah,
it'll create mold, and that mold growing creates heat, and then pretty soon you got burnt cotton on.
Insanity. Just insanely cool stuff. And so I thought about, Tom and the satisfaction he gets to have for the rest of his fucking life of looking at that awesome house. You know what I mean? And the fact that, you know, again, I'm going to bring it up. The fact that anytime his wife tries to nag on him about anything ever, any like, God damn, we all should tear down our houses for each other and rebuild them so you can look at your wife when she goes, will you take that trash out, and go, are you fucking looking around right now? Are you fucking kidding me? Are you fucking kidding me? So unfair. So unfair. But yeah, just that idea is, and it's such a, I really think it is a douchey thing. That's my honest opinion of what I'm thinking and feeling, is to say, like, I'd like to go back and do that. Get my hands dirty. Raise some maize for some cattle someday. Maybe have me some children working that land with me too. You know, like, fuck you.
Well, but the really crazy thing is, I was about your age having the same thought.
Really?
About.
I know you said you have. Yeah. I didn't make the connection.
Samuel, I was maybe 2-3 years younger than what you are now. But I mean, having that same thought of just tired of the bullshit out here.
Yeah.
Go back there for the simple life. Now, I don't think I would survive doing it. But it was a very romantic thought of it, yes.
Right. So why do I bring this up? Why do I say all this stuff on this show? And in my opinion, it's multiple purposes. I think a big purpose is that I kind of like the idea that what came out of that episode that we did with Grandpa was that there was also kind of a memorial to where he got to drop some mad parenting knowledge from, you know, a not even high school educated redneck farmer, you know, chicken farmer, cotton farmer, blah, blah, blah. And that it just lives there forever. You know what I mean? It's the closest to a statue that I think I could have. And so, and a lot of people have sent emails that when they find that about how, you know, they kind of got something out of it. And I'm really uncomfortable, as we talked about before, with compliments or anything like that. But so I'm trying to fight the voices in my head say, nobody fucking cares about any of this. But I do think it's interesting. I do think that there's a strong chance that there are people either A, that are living this kind of life that we're discussing in maybe a rural setting or something along those lines that they can resonate with. Or there are people that have the accounting jobs that are like, yeah, fuck, there's a part that maybe sounds kind of nice to go out and get on a farm and all that stuff and do all that. And maybe this is kind of like a little escape that they can have. But the big thing for me, the reason I bring it up is because for anybody who has moments like me where you think that you're expecting too much of your children, I would like to impart what I got out of this trip is a vision of my 5-year-old grandfather. He's still bald at 5 in my head. Just holding all of his weight down on a 2-row knife plow behind 2 mules in the fucking hottest, fucking dry, flattest part of Texas you'll ever fucking see in your life, and not really bitching about it.
No.
And so that means that you could fucking pick up your cars and put them in a drawer. All right, fuckhead. Quit pissing me off. You could stop bitching at me and you could say, excuse me when you fucking talk to me. You know what I mean? And we can all just kind of maybe settle it on that and ratchet up the expectations a little bit and not feel bad about it.
Well, but you knew about most of this. But by taking this trip, you got to personally see it, touch it, and now you own it.
Mm.
So it resonates a totally different thing for you.
I agree. I think the reason, though, it resonates, not because I got to see, I think it has to do with my age now. I think as much could, as I went be, back and got to ride around on a dirt bike, and I like the oil pumps, and you, like you told me, my cousin Stacy, which is your cousin's kid or whatever, like right. She remembers being like 3 years old and you taking me out to ride one of those pump jacks. For you who don't know, those are the things when you think of an oil well or oil rig, it's those little things that look like that drinking bird that CEOs
bobbing
put on their disc or whatever. Yeah.
Oil.
And so she was like, I can't believe they get to go out and do this.
And she couldn't.
And she couldn't. Her mom and dad weren't okay with it because she's only three or whatever. I don't even fucking remember it. But this is a big deal that she didn't get to go do this thing. No, also, she grew up in a fucking farm where, you know.
Well, she lives right beside it.
Yeah, she was driving tractors and shit. That's what I told her. I said, she was still kind of upset at 32 about this. Like, we could go right now. They can't tell you
get
what to
right
fucking do,
it.
You know. And she's like, no, I'm good. But so I did, I got kind of that aspect of it. But it's different now for me because until you really shit out a couple of kids, you really can't have perspective on life. And so. That's the final reason why I bring this up is that if you have family out there, if you and maybe it's I know that we joke a lot about how they're a royal pain in the ass, but what I got out of this from watching you is that there's a lot of perspective that can be gained from just going and asking some questions on how did so and so meet, how did they get together, because it's not necessarily knowing that your parents met in a fucking barn dance or whatever the fuck it might be, but it's the other anecdotes that I saw that came out of it. And I came home with, and it's stupid shit, but it's always going to remind me of this trip. I literally came home and made apple dumplings with cinnamon sugar on them and a fucking Mexican casserole because that's what my cousin and her mom made for us for dinner, lunch, whatever one day.
Right.
And I like that, and it's fucking good, and I get to share that with my kids. You know what I mean? That's the other aspect, that if you don't have that, if we look at our parents and our grandparents are like, oh, these fucking old people who talk nonsense all the time, that you kind of get to miss out on that. Or you just kind of take them for granted. I'm not even saying that they drive you nuts. Like, what you just kind of – like, I kind of feel like I did until I got older and I had some kids. And then I would talk to my grandparents and go, how did you guys meet? I'm curious how that goes. And there's even bigger questions that I would love to be able to ask. And watching, you know, you kept saying it to Edith. It's like you kept saying, trust me, you need to ask these questions now because I got left with kind of a book of questions and no way to get a direct answer.
I only had a couple of chapters filled in.
And she's got a direct link right there to the guy who saw it all kind of thing.
Right.
So, I don't know. Any other thoughts on that before we wrap it up?
No. Well, like I said, it was just a thing for me, for my father. He never got to take that motorcycle ride. It was a thing of sharing with you. And then on the whim, we just up and do an iron butt ride.
Oh, that's right. That's the part. I forgot about that.
Because.
On his birthday. It was his birthday this last Friday on October 25th.
He would have been 82. But an iron butt ride is 1,000 miles in 24 hours. And it's documented with like gas receipts and when you left and all this. And it was sort of something that just popped into my head because on the GPS, I was setting it up for our return trip. And lo and behold, from Plains, Texas to Burbank, 1,096 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So we just...
And it said we would get there at 10:30.
10:30 took us to 1:30.
Right. But no, but when you see 10:30, you kind of go, that's not that bad. Like, that's not late at night.
Right. No, but I mean...
And we gained 2 hours because of time zones.
Right. But yeah, it was... And you have to understand, too, my trips to Texas as a child were just straight through, burn them up, pack a bag of sandwiches, stop for gas.
We don't stop. Yeah, just
we
gas.
Don't stop. We're going straight through. So,
piss in a cup and keep on going.
Right. So it was just all rolled into one, and it rolled off. It was perfect.
Right. It really was. I really liked. I like that we took our time. I think that the original plan, or not even, I know you said there wasn't much of a plan, but the original concept was that we literally would go there, visit for a day, scatter some ashes, turn around, and come back.
Right.
and that we stayed there for 2 days. And I'm so glad that we did because it was so much fun. Like, we got in at 11 o'clock and stayed up till 4 in the morning talking to your cousins and laughing and just so much fucking laughing. And then getting to – and it was great for me. Like, it was kind of a little bit of a – I don't know. What's the word that I'm trying to think of? Not vengeance. It's or reprieve. Like I got this – I don't know. What I'm trying to say is I was a real pussy as a kid. And so I got to interact with my your Uncle William, my great Uncle William, and make him laugh and tell some jokes. And he commented. He's like, he goes, what? He kind of looks at Randy, and he was like, this little timid kid. What? Where did he
what
freaking
goes up
go?
With him?
Yeah, and because I was making him laugh, and I was goofing, and it was great for me. I hope I don't know, but for and I know I'm filling in a lot of this. But what was cool is that everybody kept saying about how much of they like to say the word card or character. That's the word that they use for a crack up that Grandpa was. Mm-hmm. That he was always that way, and I got to hear these cool stories of how. I'll tell that after this. But my point is to say that there was a little bit of, like, I hope that he gets to look at me and go, wow, it's interesting to see what that generational thing kind of does. You know what I mean? Because I do feel like in a lot of ways, Grandpa heavily influenced my desire to make people laugh, to crack them up, to fuck with them a little, or, you know what I mean, say something a little weird. And is that Grandpa, my grandfather was in the Korean War, but he was drafted. And him and his brother were assigned to the same company. And so that one of the days they were like, is there anybody here that could cook, you know? And so my grandpa raised his hand, but grandpa really didn't. Grandpa liked to cook, but he didn't know how to cook.
No.
Because his mother, as you have said, is notorious for just burning the shit out of everything.
Burned everything.
And so he signed up and he got by watching my great uncle tell these great stories of, you know, they would do roll call in the morning and they would say, Worsham, and he would just say yes twice. And so my grandfather,
he was sleeping
in his barracks.
His brother was doing roll call for him.
Yeah, exactly. Not even intentionally, really. Just like, Worsham, here, Worsham, here, you know. And like Helen even said that it's like he just thought they didn't hear him. And they said it again, like there was no way to know. And just, you know, and he said that his commanding officer really liked him. And he goes, but he said, Worsham, he goes, I've never seen you where your face didn't need a shave. You know, like all these things. And
now you know why I wear a beard.
Right. And that's what I mean. It's interesting to see a man who was drafted and a person. It's anybody. I think everybody can relate to this. Like if you ever see a picture of a candid moment of your grandparent in their like teens or 20s.
He was about 22.
It was really that's really weird for me. And it's where I really wish we had a time machine because I would really love to. Two things. I would love to sit down and talk to Grandpa when he's like 18, 19, 20, something along those lines.
Oh, wow.
And then I would also like to just kind of sit back from afar, Star Trek style, and look at CB when he first gets there and offloads all that shit and gets that farm.
Let's
and
go home.
Watch a time lapse of that shit. You know what I mean? Just kind of watch all that unfold. And I think what's interesting, too, is that my generation of children will have that, you know? Because that was what I got to see you talk and ask questions, and they were talking about the farm and the history and how everybody came to be and why this land is here and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there looking at William and Helen, your uncle, my grandfather's older brother, and his wife, and I go, there's going to be a certain point where my son will be them in this kind of a situation. And that they're going to be talking about somebody, and that somebody could be me or even you or even Grandpa. And that somebody's not even going to have a fucking clue what they look like other than a still picture on the wall of their living room or whatever. I feel like I'm getting really heavy-handed with this show, and it's bothering me. But I don't know. That's all the shit that was going on in my mind. And I try to be as honest as I can because, A, I think it's better this way. But I found that in these moments where I have these doubts that these are the ones that I get the most emails that are like, I really like that. That was really cool. And or I'm going through that kind of thing right now and blah, 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 blah. But we did that, and then to end it with this Iron Butt run, which was, I think, weird, but it was weird that it was, or not weird, but cool that it was on his birthday, but I think it was more of a thing that you and I would just do, like, regardless of this trip back to Texas. Like, it just...
Well, but that was the other thing, too. It was something that he never had the opportunity to do, but it would also be something that he would be impressed that we were doing it together and sharing it.
Right.
So it was just.
And I like the idea that it, you know, that I have a neighbor who rides a motorcycle full time, and if I tell him that I rode 1,096 miles in 19 hours, he's going to be fucking nuts. Because well, as we talked about last week, before we even left, we were telling my neighbors about this. They were like, "We're going to go to places." And they were like, "What the fuck are you doing? You're like, you've never been on a like they knew I hadn't been on a motorcycle in you know 10 years or more." Better. And I'm just like, "Oh, you're just going to jump on it and go 1,000 miles? Yeah, good fucking luck with that." And it wasn't. I mean, I was riding a Goldwing, and it was fucking a year old, so it's not. That's why, but it wasn't that bad. It was fun. It was fun. I listened to a shit ton of podcasts. And
but when you look at most people, they wouldn't even travel that much in a car, let alone on a motorcycle.
It's true.
And even personal friends of mine think I'm nuts for the trips or things that I do. And they were going, "You're going to go to Texas and back in a week and take care." You know, they just don't comprehend.
My God, do that. That's the other thing I took out of the walk. You told me how beautiful it was to drive, but seeing those mountains and stuff in Arizona, New Mexico and all that stuff, like, I don't care where you fucking live. Rent one of those bullshit RVs and just find little campsites.
Cruise out there.
And just fuck around with your kids and let them play their Game Boys and shit while you're driving down the road, and everybody will be comfortable. There'll be family moments and it'll, but.
Well, you just get out there and you take in this total expanse of everything. I mean, as far as you see, there's just these hills, this, that. And then, like, when we were coming back in, the rain clouds coming in and getting rain.
Oh, yeah, we even got to drive through rain and hail.
Lightning, hail.
Yeah, wind.
All of these elements that you're experiencing, and you don't get to do that in a car.
Right.
And it just...
It was just cool. Right, too, because we were on Gold Wings, and there's a fairing. Like, I didn't really get fucking drenched.
Our pants didn't even get wet.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't that bad, but you're out there, and you're doing
it. You're fighting it. You're fighting the wind. You're fighting the rain. Yeah, it's exciting.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
That was a shit ton of fun. That, and I feel like I'm being so douchey and blowhardy, but really life changing. Honestly, it was.
It was for me. We have a close relationship, but we've never shared things like that.
True.
We've never, and it wasn't like a father-son type thing. It was just two equal individuals out sharing this time on the road.
Right.
And to me, out traveling on the road like that is the best. And people think I'm nuts, but I truly enjoy it. I truly like pushing myself to do things that no other person is really going to go, "Hey, let's do that."
Yeah.
I just like it.
Yeah, that's funny. You just made me, when you said that, you helped me articulate what an iron butt run will be for me. Because you said, you go, "Well, you're supposed to do these few things." And I'm like, "Well, fuck it. We could just do it and know that we did it. Like,
right.
I don't need a badge to put on a jacket.
I don't need a certificate."
Right. I fucking know I did it. I was there for it. That's the closest that this chubby guy could ever get to a marathon. You know what I mean? Like that's my, I'm sure there was a wall, like I hit a wall of hail. You know what I mean? That scared the shit out of me, that hail. And I pushed through it. And then there's the endorphins you get when you pull into those familiar freeways of Southern California. And I was like, "Ha ha, we did it.
Made it to safety."
You know what I mean? And,
but you push yourself to experiences you've not done before and look at what you gain out of it.
Right. Cute. Oh, my gosh. Just everywhere from just new fucking things to make for dinner to I know that I'm doing good things for my kids by just saying, fucking just do it.
Right.
Just fucking do it because you're supposed to.
Quit whining.
And then there's a lot of, like, me and the things I bitch about and the things I get emotional about that, you know what I mean? Like, I realize kind of watching all the stuff that it's not just because redneck farmer cowboys are grown to be so masculine that they don't feel emotions. It's the same kind of stuff on a much smaller scale, but it's the same kind of thing like in societies where there's no water to drink or food to eat, that they don't have fucking time to worry about everybody's ego and what shirt the color they're wearing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And so there's just a different set of priorities. And so that's why I think that it stands to reason that they would have a little less what we would consider psychological problems. Although I did learn that a lot of farmers commit suicide when things get really, really fucking rough.
Yeah, but that's just from the stress and the
of course.
Money.
So everybody has stress.
Everybody.
But I don't know. I guess I'm just saying, you know, fucking pull a Tom. Build something with your kids. Fucking do something with your hands. Even if it's a fucking garden or something that you like to do. Get on an RV And I don't mean that because I know this isn't an advice show. I'm just saying, hey, I had this experience, and I'm telling you that it really can make you feel whole as a father and as a parent
as
if you
person.
Do that shit.
Get out and experience new things. Challenge yourself to do.
And in closing, Mrs. Tom, let's throw a BJ to Mr. Tom. I have to stop doing this. It's really funny to me.
Damn, Tom's going to get upset.
No,
well, actually,
he already said, yeah, he laughed.
Mrs. Tom's going to get upset.
Well, I don't know. Maybe she's into that thing. You know, maybe she works those that scrotum
she
sack.
She likes
some
being
Chinese,
told.
Some Chinese worry balls. We don't know. We don't know, Mrs. Tom. I mean, seriously, let's honestly, if we honestly broke it down, Mrs. Tom, if she found, she, because I always say, if you bagged a man like Tom, you got to be a cool fucking chick. You know what I mean?
Be.
That's a winner. You know what I mean? You don't just fucking fall on that in the lottery. I'm
that's
sure he's got
man.
His foibles. I mean, here's the problem. I mean, a man like Tom who's going to build a fucking house that got tore down by a hurricane, he's going to have some back hair. You
yes.
know what I mean? He's not going to groom his eyebrows. And
true.
You know, he may stink every now and then because he's a goddamn man, damn it.
He's a real man.
All right. Don't get too big ahead about this, Tom. All right? Otherwise, it's antithetical to who you are. And I got to stop talking about Tom. But I do think it's really funny to talk about his wife owing him a BJ because he built a fucking house for you, woman. All right. Well, that was our show. Thanks so much. Let me know what you think of this. Please send me an email to show@thedadpodcast.com. I will take all forms of criticism, but in all fairness, unless you're paying the $2 a month and you tell me that it's shitty, I'm not going to really care. That's more to make me laugh. Maybe true. I don't know. We'll see when it happens. But the big thing, yes, like I said, Facebook.com/thedadpodcast, Twitter @dadpodcast, all that stuff. But go to thedadpodcast.com and please become a paid subscriber. All you got to do is do $2 a month. If everybody listening to the show did that, it would change my life. And I would, here's the thing. I want to do some more episodes, and I actually have professionals that are imparting their expertise for free. I have a family therapist, and I have a pediatrician that's giving out information for free, and I would love to be able to throw some coin to these fantastic people. And my new kind of thing that I'm trying to, you know, throw a little perspective, although I really do think that it's just harder for people to remember. So two things. Number one, what would you miss more, $2 a month or this show? And number two, is it is that you don't remember, then fucking hit pause right now and put a little reminder or fucking send yourself a text message or something like that and say, hey, go to thedadpodcast.com, become a paid subscriber. $24 a year or $2 a month. Either way, it's the same amount of money. You know how to do the math. I think that's it. So on behalf of my father, Jesse, this is Justin Warsham saying stay frosty.